Application number 0461365 et al. Representing copies of the Medicaid email petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. In so service of the petitioner, Mr. Barnes, the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. For the petitioner, the board uses unsubstantial evidence of anti-union animus here to springboard over its duty seriously to consider W&M Properties' non-discriminatory reasons for its hiring decisions. That's the crux of the case here. The springboard is defective, though, and the reason is that a significant part of it rests on a wrong fact assumption. The W&M official, Gerrit Blauvelt, is alleged to have said to Joe Mora, who's the predecessor's building manager, that it didn't matter that Trizecon employees belonged to the union, but that is because they would have to be non-union or they would not be hired. But if Your Honors will look at the record at A245, you'll find out that Blauvelt did not say that. In fact, that seems to have been a gratuitous assumption by Mora. Those were his words, yet the board put those words into Blauvelt's mouth. Blauvelt only confirmed what W&M had a lawful right to do, not adopt the union contract. That is, what he said was the job would be non-union. He didn't say the employees were going to be non-union. That's a very significant difference. Now,
the job would be non-union, but the employee, what's the difference?
The job would be non-union, meaning?
What do you mean when you say the job would be non-union? It means anybody in the job couldn't be on the union.
No, sir. That's what Mora assumed, but that's not
what I'm assuming now. I don't even know about Mr. Mora. I'm trying to get you to explain to me, where's the nuance? What am I missing?
Your Honor,
someone, I have this job. It will be non-union.
The reason is,
what does that mean?
The difference is because employees can be union members on a job, and that job not be covered by union contract, meaning it's not a union job. That's a slang in the industry. When you say this isn't a union job, you're saying it's done.
I worked in this field a long time, and I've never heard anyone cut it like that. If you say to someone, this is a non-union, this will be a non-union job, no one misunderstands what that means.
Well, Your Honor,
you may not be a union member, but you'll have no union rights in my place. You can carry whatever card you want, but it'll be irrelevant because this job is non-union. That's what it means.
I submit to Your Honor that that's, again, not the distinction that ought to be drawn, and the cases that do find illegality when it's not are cases where the employer makes it clear that union membership is not going to be permitted. In fact, the cases cited by the board, some of them are union organizing cases, and some of the cases decided by this court involve specific evidence of the employer doing specific things to ensure that the job is not going to be populated by union members. They put qualifications in the applications. They interrogate employees to ascertain their union sympathies and predilections.
Let me tell you what the testimony says. Morris' testimony is, Garrett told me if anyone was going to work for W&M, that it would have to be non-union. And I says, but these guys are union. Now, how do you get where you just got?
Because he goes on to say that he says that because this would have to be, I said, meaning Mora in his testimony.
No, he says, I says, but these guys are union.
But then he goes on.
Preceded by, if anyone's going to work for W&M, that would have to be non-union.
But then Mora does say, but these guys are union, but Gerrit Blauvelt does not say that they would not be hired because they're union members?
If anyone was going to work for W&M, they'd have to be non-union. How could it be more clear than that?
He says, Mora says he's saying that. Blauvelt.
No, that's not what it says. That's not. Gerrit told me if anyone was going to work for W&M, that it would have to be non-union.
That the job was going to be non-union, Your Honor.
In circles, okay.
Your Honor, the cases are pretty clear that that when you are discriminating on that basis that you've just said, that there has to be specific evidence of that. The case that the board relies upon, in fact, plan building, says that. There has to be substantial evidence. There has to be, as we pointed out at page 31 of our brief, there has to be clear evidence of anti-union motive and or acts taken to undertake and carry out that anti-union motive. That didn't happen here. A few comments by Blauvelt doesn't arise to that level. But let's assume, Your Honors, let's assume that the prima facie case was made. We have this eavesdrops call that Morrow overheard, and he testified about that the board ignores, where the W&M executives were not talking about the union at all. They were talking about the lack of work ethic in the staff, and they were talking about overtime costs. If there ever was an opportunity to discover what was really at the heart of the motive of the employer, that would be it. Yet, there was nothing except legitimate concerns expressed by those officials in that call.
Counsel, let me ask you about something different. You asked that we invalidate the make-whole remedy imposed by the board. Haven't you waived that challenge?
Your Honor, we submit to you that we have not. The Act Section 10E has an extraordinary circumstances exception that folks seem to have ignored here. Here we have a situation where the board changed its remedy in a footnote in its decision upholding the administrative law judge here. But in a footnote in plan building, footnote 23, the board made it absolutely clear that notwithstanding this court's opposition to that remedy.
Was there a motion to reconsider that decision in plan building?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't.
Has that argument in plan building ever been challenged since it was announced in plan building?
I think plan building has been appealed, but I do not know for sure whether that argument.
Then can you cite us to any case in which we have held that an argument was patently futile, where it has not already been raised before the board and rejected by the board? Can you find, do you know of a single example where you found patent futility under those circumstances?
Not specific to 10E, Your Honor, but I submit to Your Honor that where this court tells the board they're wrong and the board is determined to ignore this court, which is what footnote 23 makes plain, then why would the board get an epiphany just because we make a motion for reconsideration and agree with us when it won't agree with this court? So to answer Judge Brown your question, I don't think there's been waiver here. I think there's been a clear situation that where objection by this court has instructed the board that it's wrong. And we know that. And we don't think it's necessary to embark upon a futile mission to get the board to change its mind. There has been no ambush here. The board argues in its brief, oh, the underlying reason for that section is so they don't get ambushed. Well, what that is repeating an incantation without any meaning. What happened here was, Your Honors, that the board did not undertake its but-for duty. If there was animus, without conceding there wasn't sufficient showing of that, the board then can't just ignore properly evaluating the employer's reasons for its hiring decisions, but they did that here. Instead, the board adopted the administrative law judge's because test. Because Wienand Malkin didn't want the union and made inherently coercive statements. Because Wiener Melkin was willing to hire Mora despite the fact that the building maintenance was poor and he supervised the building, the Mora paradox. Therefore, none of W&M Properties' evidence should be given any credence, and the witnesses shouldn't be believed. Oh, they must have exaggerated the condition of the property because of all of this. But this is subjective evidence that must be considered, that was simply swept aside. And, Your Honors, when the only opportunity that W&M Properties had to get anything about these employees, to learn about them at all, was through the interviews and the walkthroughs, that is the subjective evidence. Because Trizac Khan and Mora refused to turn over the employee records, and because they weren't given resumes as they asked, the only way they could evaluate anybody was to talk to them. But the board ignores that evidence, and that's what's the wrong in this case, Your Honors. They didn't follow their own test. The employer has a right to choose employees who are leaders, who are proactive, but the board ridicules it. The ALJ, at her footnote 20 at A752, said Bonus was being hired to give expert direction to the staff not to lead a platoon into war. Well, Your Honors, the employer has a right, if it wants proactive employees and employees with initiative and leadership, and it perceives employees to have that or not to have that, can make decisions on that basis. And that view should be respected by the agency, not mocked. And so,
Counsel, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jeff Barham, and I represent the National Labor Relations Board in this matters. Your Honor, there can be little doubt that there's substantial evidence underlying the board's decision here to find that the company had an unlawful motive, union avoidance, in rejecting the bulk of its predecessor's employees. First, there is direct evidence of the company's motive on this record, and
mind just switching the time short and going to the give us your view clearly on the make whole remedy.
On the make-whole remedy? Well, Your Honor, our view is certainly that the company has waived that.
Assume it's waived. Just play out your argument.
Well, Your Honor, maybe I should start by commending this court to a decision passed down just last week in the UFCW versus NLRB case. In that case, the company, in fact, had filed exceptions to the board's failure, or to the ALJ's failure to put in a remedy. The board, as it arguably did here, sua sponte, said that, well, in that case, they said, we're not going to put in the remedy, but for a different reason. The union didn't move for reconsideration, and this court said, you can't do it. You're 10E'd. You know, you're barred by 10E from now raising that different argument about the remedy in this court. That there wasn't even that much done here. In this case, the ALJ demanded a remedy that was harsher to the company than the one the board actually imposed. The ALJ's remedy required the company to institute its predecessor's contract terms up until the point that they negotiated new terms or they negotiated the impasse, period. There was no further option. The board, pursuant to its decision in Planned Building Services, has now given the company an option to go to a compliance hearing to put on evidence that, in fact, you know, had they negotiated, had they not discriminated against their employees, but had they, in fact, recognized the union and negotiated, they would have arrived at a contract with terms that were less favorable than their predecessor contract terms. So, in fact, the company now, when they object to this new remedy, they're objecting to a remedy that's better for them than the one that they apparently had no problems with.
I'm arguing with utility, but you're saying that this is board made an attempt to accommodate to some extent capital, our decision in capital.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I certainly think there's also no merit to their futility argument, and they have.
You're saying at bottom that they should have recognized this was a change, a favorable change, and an attempted accommodation. So futility makes no sense, because if it's an attempted accommodation, then you've got to fight back and preserve your argument.
That's correct, Your Honor. And at no point in this litigation have they preserved that argument.
Do you think that we should apply the, is it NLRB versus FLRA case? Should we apply that here to the waiver issue?
No, Your Honor, and I'm trying to remember the facts of that case. I believe that the way that futility was in fact found in that case was that the FLRA in that case had applied a legal standard over and over and over again. In this case, we have, and as the company makes the argument, in effect, well, as they say, it's a brand new standard. Certainly for the remedy, there is something new here in plan building services. And as you pointed out, that no court has yet passed on that, and the board has simply, you know, applied that now to somewhat of a backlog of cases where they were waiting for that distinction to be made. This case is
certainly NLRB versus FLRA has a more generous view of waiver, construing a different statute but with the same language. And I'm just wondering if you think that we ought to take the learning from that and apply it here.
Well, I think, Your Honors, if you look at the language of that case, there it is still somewhat circumspect about going around 10E. Certainly, it is virtually the same standard under a different statute. But I believe that the reason they went around it in that case was finding that in fact this had gone this particular rule, the rule at issue in that case, had been applied over and over and over again. And in fact, there was very little chance that by the board filing a motion for reconsideration that there'd be something new to be gained there. They combined that with the sua sponte nature of what happened in that particular case. Certainly we don't have those facts here. May I also take issue with the argument my opponent raised about the direct evidence in the record? We spent some time talking about Mora's testimony. He did not talk about the other incident where Blauvel sort of admitted or exposed the company's union avoidance motive. If you look at page 122 of the record, where Perez is describing his interaction with Blauvel, the testimony is the owners, they didn't want a union. Now, I don't know how we could be any clearer than that, further, you know, aside from what was going on with Mora, but that's quite clear testimony. The judge talked about why, in particular, she credited Perez on this statement, and the company has never raised any argument about why that credibility determination was wrong. Furthermore, I find it interesting that the company continues to press this evidence of the eavesdrop call as somehow evidence that should be helpful to them. Again, if this court looks at the appendix, I believe it's at page 275, that's where Mora is talking about that call. He says, "They were calling me to find out some particulars of the union contract." That's what that telephone call was about. So they're calling to ask questions about the union contract, which apparently they've just discovered. And in that conversation, they talk about the engineers and the mechanics being overpaid. Now, certainly I don't think it's a far-reaching inference at all to say that, well, the reason they think they're overpaid is because of the union contract, because they're unionized. That was a fair inference for the ALJ to draw. It's a fair inference for the board to draw. It certainly doesn't become evidence that the company had a pure motive here in discriminating against these unionized employees. Furthermore, with the principles that the ALJ and subsequently the board found to be pretext that the company relied on, there was testimony about the building disrepair. What the company never explained, certainly at the hearing, what it never explained in its brief, what it hasn't explained now, is why, if the building was in such disrepair and if it blamed it on the employees generally, how did it pick out two employees and absolve them from responsibility? And I'm not talking yet here about Mora, about the supervisor who's ultimately in charge, but in fact they offered jobs to Perez and Benitez. And again, if you look at 548 in the appendix, Vice President Heller admits that he made no effort to discover whether Perez and Benitez were in fact responsible for the deficiencies that he saw on his tours of the building. That in itself casts some pretty serious doubt on whether these deficiencies were as bad as the company claimed that they were. There were also, in particular, they testified about lighting troubles in there. But again, there's clear testimony from the company, from Blovell, in the record, saying that Benitez, the person they offered the job to, his duties were pretty much restricted to changing light bulbs. So the only evidence we have here is that, in fact, Benitez may have been uniquely responsible for these supposed deficiencies. But again, that didn't stand in the way of the company offering him a job. And certainly, in the end, there is also Mora, that Mora, not only does he have responsibility for overseeing all of these engineers and mechanics on site, but he also has responsibility for overseeing the subcontractors who are working on the building. The company brought up several problems it had in areas that were being covered by subcontractors, but yet they wanted to pin that to Bonos and the engineers and not to Mora. Mora, they were still willing to consider for hire quite late in the process after they already blamed all of these supposed problems on the engineers and mechanics. In short, Your Honors, the judge and the board had quite a bit of evidence for discrediting the company's claims here. If you look at the judge's analysis, the judge certainly pitches it in credibility terms and says that after seeing that they were exaggerating their testimony in these other areas, I certainly found them less credible than the employees. So it's kind of a strain for the company to go now, to go to what happened in the employees' interviews, something that certainly can't be measured by the judge or the company, after they've thrown out all of these exaggerations that the judge has legitimately found to be pretexts. Finally, Your Honors, the company makes some noise about a new standard here in planned building services. I would submit that there in fact is no difference whether you analyze this case under FES or under planned building services, and their attempt to have this court think otherwise is really just an attempt to take your attention away from the weak facts in this case. Thank you very much. We ask you to affirm.
Thank you. You can have a minute of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. I need to point out a couple of things that are important about counsel's argument. First, credibility is a misnomer here. These weren't credibility determinations because the judge seemed to base her quote-unquote credibility on unchallenged evidence. There was no challenged evidence. The testimony from these employees was never directed toward what the employer was presenting as far as evidence as to the disrepair of the building or the demeanor shown in these interviews and so forth. We had Sofco, who never even testified, yet in his interview he said he didn't like the job the way it was described to him, too much responsibility. We had Schmidt, who wasn't even part of the complaint but was hired by Bonus to be his assistant chief, who in fact had been fired earlier by W&M Properties on a different job. We had Bonus himself, who was arrogant and rude to his prospective employers and fidgeted and shifted in his chair and chewed gum, a lot like what I call the sunglass case, which is a board case that lead aviation that upheld a refusal to assign a person to a shift, not because of his union activities, but because he wore sunglasses in his interview. So these are matters that are it's a shell game to say there were real credibility determinations here. There weren't. We had McGowan, who we were going to hire until we found out after looking at the equipment that he was supposed to have cared for. He actually didn't. It was in disrepair. In fact, the record shows that Mora told Heller about the two individuals we did give job offers to, Benitez and Perez, that they were great employees. And Mora ultimately acknowledged that the ability of these employees seem to be in inverse order to their seniority. And finally, as far as their, as the eavesdrops call, it's one thing to talk about and analyze a union contract, and it's another thing to oppose the union per se. And by the way, This court has said in a case decided this month that it's okay to make anti-union statements as long as you don't act on them. You can hope for the result you want as long as you don't act on them. Thank you, Your Honor.